You name it, we had it, the old guy said. We've had farm workers' union boys from the peanut farms. We've had farm workers' union boys from the peach growers. We've had civil rights girls from the voter registration. We've had boys who didn't want their ass sent to Vietnam. You name it, we had it. Finley nodded. And now you've got us, he said. Local trouble? The barber asked. Finley nodded again. Big trouble, he said. Big changes coming. Been expecting it, the old guy said. Been expecting it for years. You have? Finley said. The barber nodded and stood up, stepped over to a large closet, opened the door and waved us over to take a look. It was a big closet fitted with deep shelves. The shelves were stacked with money. Bricks and bricks of cash held together with rubber bands. It filled the closet from floor to ceiling. Must have been a couple of $100,000 in there. Kleiner Foundation money, the old guy said. They just keep on throwing it at us. Something wrong with it. I'm 74 years old. 70 years people are pissing all over me. Now people are throwing money all over me. Something wrong with that, right? He closed the door on the cash. We don't spend it, he said. We don't spend a cent we don't earn. We just put it in the closet. You boys going after the Kleiner Foundation? Tomorrow there won't be any Kleiner Foundation, I said. The old guy just nodded, glanced at the closet door as he passed by and shook his head, closed the door on us, and left us alone in the small, cozy room. Not going to be easy, Finley said. Three of us and three of them. They hold four hostages. Two of the hostages are children. We're not even certain where they're holding them. They're at the warehouse, I said. That's for sure. Where else would they be? No manpower available to hold them anyplace else. And you heard that tape, that boomy echo? That was the warehouse, for sure. What tape? Hubble asked. Finley looked at him. They had Roscoe make a tape for Reacher, he said. A message to prove they were holding her. Roscoe? Hubble said. What about Charlie? Finley shook his head. Just Roscoe, he lied. Nothing from Charlie. Hubble nodded. Smart move, Harvard guy, I thought. The image of Charlie being held down at a microphone with a sharp knife at her throat would have tipped Hubble right over the edge, right off the plateau, back down to where panic would make him useless. The warehouse is where they are, I said again. No doubt about it. Hubble knew the warehouse well. He'd been working up there most days for a year and a half, so we got him to go over and over it, describing the layout. We found paper and pencil and got him to draw plans. We went over and over the plans, putting in all the doors, the stairs, the distances, the details. We ended up with the sort of drawing an architect would have been proud of. The warehouse stood in its own compound at the end of the row of four. It was very close in line with the third shed, which was a farmer's operation. There was a fence running between the two with just a path's width between it and the metal siding. The other three sides were ringed by the main fence running around the whole complex. That fence ran close to the warehouse across the back and down the far end, but there was plenty of space in front for trucks to turn. The big roller door covered just about the whole of the front wall. There was a small staff door just around the far corner which gave on to the main floor. There was a cage just inside the staff door where the roller door winch was sighted. Go in the staff door and turn left. There was an open metal staircase running up to an office. The office was cantilevered way up into the top back corner of the huge shed, hanging there about 40 feet above the main floor. The office had big windows and a railed balcony looking down into the shed for supervision. In back, the office had a door leading out to an external fire escape, which was another open metal staircase bolted to the outside back wall. Okay, I said. Clear enough, right? Finley shrugged. I'm worried about reinforcements, he said. Guards on the exterior. I shrugged back. There won't be reinforcements, I said. I'm more worried about the shotguns. It's a big space, and there are two kids in there. Finley nodded, looked grim. He knew what I was saying. Shotguns spray a cone of lead over a big, wide angle. Shotguns and children don't mix. We went quiet. It was nearly 2 in the morning, an hour and a half to wait. We would leave at 3:30, get up there at 4. My favorite attack time. The waiting period. Like soldiers in a dugout, like pilots before a raid. It was silent. Finley dozed. He had done this before, probably many times. He sprawled in his chair. His left arm hung over the side. Half of the shattered handcuff dangled from his wrist, like a silver bracelet. Hubble sat upright. He hadn't done this before. He just fidgeted around, burning energy. Couldn't blame him. He kept looking over at me, questions in his eyes. I just kept on shrugging back at him. 2:30, there was a knock on the door. Just a soft tap. The door opened a foot. The older of the two old barbers was there. He pointed a gnarled and trembling finger into the room, aimed straight at me.
"I want to see you, son," he said.
Finley sat up, and Hubble looked scared. I signaled them both to stay put. Stood up and pulled the big automatic out of my pocket, clicked the safety off. The old guy flapped his hand at me and fussed.
"You don't need that, son," he said. "Don't need that at all."
He was impatient, beckoning me out to join him. I put the gun away again, shrugged at the other two, and went with the old guy. He led me into a tiny kitchen. There was a very old woman in there, sitting on a stool. Same mahogany color as the old guy, stick thin. She looked like an old tree in winter.
"This is my sister," the old barber said. "You boys woke her up, chattering."
Then he stepped over to her, bent down, and spoke right in her ear.
"This is the boy I told you about," he said.
She looked up and smiled at me. It was like the sun coming out. I caught a flash of the beauty she must have had long ago. She held out her hand, and I took it. Felt like thin wires in a soft, dry glove. The old barber left us alone together in the kitchen, stopped as he passed me.
"Ask her about him," he said.
The old guy shuffled out. I still had the old lady's hand in mine. I squatted down next to her. She didn't try to pull her hand away, just left it nestled there, like a brown twig in my huge paw.
"I don't hear so good," she said. "You got to lean close."
I spoke in her ear. She smelled like an old flower, like a faded bloom.
"How's this?"
I said.
"That's good, son," she said. "I can hear that okay."
"I was asking your brother about blind Blake," I said.
"I know that, son," she said. "He told me all about it."
"He told me you knew him," I said in her ear.
"I sure did," she said. "I knew him real well."
"Will you tell me about him?" I asked her. She turned her head and gazed at me sadly.
"What's the tale?" she said. "He been gone a real long time."
"What was he like?" I said. She was still gazing at me. Her eyes were misting over as she trawled backward 60, 70 years.
"He was blind," she said.
She didn't say anything more for a while. Her lips fluttered soundlessly, and I could feel a strong pulse hammering in her bony wrist. She moved her head as if she was trying to hear something from far away.
"He was blind," she said again. "And he was a sweet boy."
She was more than 90 years old. She was as old as the 20th century. So she was remembering back to her 20s and 30s. Not to her childhood or her teens. She was remembering back to her womanhood. And she was calling Blake a sweet boy.
"I was a singer," she said. "And he played the guitar. You know that old expression? He could play the guitar just like rang in the bell, huh? That's what I used to say about Blake. He would pick up that old instrument here, and a note would just come tumbling out, faster than you could sing them. But each note was just a perfect little silver bell floating off into the air. We'd sing and play all night long. Then in the morning, I'd lead him out into a meadow, and we'd sit under some old shade tree, and we'd sing and play some more, just for the joy of it. Just because I could sing, and he could play."
She hummed a couple of bars of something under her breath. Her voice was about a fifth lower pitch than it ought to have been.
She was so thin and fragile you'd have expected a high, faltering soprano, but she was singing with a low, breathy contralto. I thought back with her and put the two of them in an old Georgia meadow. The heavy smell of wildflower blossom, the buzz of lazy noontime insects, the two of them, backs against a tree, singing and playing for the joy of it, belting out the wry, defiant songs that Blake had made up and that I loved so much. "What happened to him?" I asked her. "Do you know?" She nodded.
"Two people on this earth know that," she whispered. "I'm one of them."
"Will you tell me?" I said. "I sort of came down here to find out."
62 years, she said. "I never told a soul in 62 years.
"Will you tell me?" I asked her again. She nodded, sadly, tears in her misty old eyes.
62 years,
she said.
"You're the first person ever asks me."
I held my breath. Her lips fluttered and her hands scrabbled in my palm.
"He was blind," she said. "But he was sporty. You know that word? Sporty? It means kind of uppity. Uppity with a smile and a grin is sporty. Blake was sporty. Had a lot of spirit and energy. Walked fast and talk fast, always moving, always smiling his sweet fool head off. But one time, we came out of a place in town here, walking down the sidewalk, laughing. Nobody else around but for two white folks coming toward us on the sidewalk, a man and a boy. I saw them and ducked off the sidewalk like we were supposed to do, stood in the dirt to let them pass. But poor Blake was blind, didn't see them. Just crashed into that white boy. A white boy, maybe 10 years old, maybe 12. Blake sent him flying into the dirt. White boy cut his head on a stone, set up such a hollering like you never heard. The white boy's daddy was there with him. I knew him. He was a big, important man in this town. His boy was screaming, fit to burst, screaming at his daddy to punish the nigger. So the daddy lost his temper and set about Blake with his cane. A big silver knob on the top. He beat poor Blake with that cane until his head was just split open like a burst watermelon. Killed him stone dead. Picked up the boy and turned to me. Sent me over to the horse trough to wash poor Blake's hair and blood and brains off from the end of his cane. Told me never to say a word about it, or he'd kill me too. So I just hid out and waited until somebody else found poor Blake there on the sidewalk. Then I ran out screaming and hollering with the rest of them all. Never said a word about it to another living soul. That day to this.
Big wet tears were welling out of her eyes and rolling slowly down her thin cheeks. I reached over and smudged them dry with the back of my finger, took her other hand in mine. "Who was the boy?" I asked her.
"Somebody I've seen around ever since," she said. "Somebody I've seen sneering around just about every day since, reminding me of my poor Blake lying there with his head split open."
"Who was he?" I said.
"It was an accident," she said. "Anybody could have seen that. Poor Blake was a blind man. Boy didn't have to set up such a hollering. He wasn't hurt so bad. He was old enough to know better. It was his fault for hollering and screaming like he did."
"Who was the boy?" I asked her again. She turned to me and stared into my eyes. Told me the 62-year-old secret.
"Grover Teal," she said. "Grew up to be mayor, just like his old daddy. Thinks he's king of the damn world, but he's just a screaming brat who got my poor Blake killed for no reason at all, except he was blind and he was black."
Chapter 33. We piled back into Charlie's black Bentley in the alley behind the barber shop. Nobody spoke. I fired it up, swung out and rolled north, kept the lights off and drove slow. The big, dark sedan rolled north through the night like a stealthy animal leaving its lair, like a big, black submarine slipping its mooring and gliding out into icy water. I drove through the town and pulled up shy of the station house, quiet as a tomb. "I want to get a weapon," Finley said. We picked our way through the shattered wreckage of the entrance. Hubble's own Bentley was sitting in the squad room, inert in the gloom. The front tires had blown, and it had settled nose down, buried in the wreckage of the cells. There was a stink of gasoline. The tank must have split. The trunk lid was up because of the way the rear end was smashed in. Hubble didn't even glance at it. Finley picked his way past the wrecked car to the big office and back, disappeared inside. I waited with Hubble in the heap of shards that had been the entrance doors. Finley came back out of the dark with a stainless steel revolver and a book of matches and a grin. He waved the two of us out to the car and struck a match, threw it under the rear of the wrecked green Bentley, and crunched on out to join us.
"Diversion, right?" he said.
We saw the fire start as we nosed out of the lot. Bright blue flames were rolling across the carpet like a wave on the beach. The fire took hold of the splintered wood and rolled outward, feeding itself on the huge gasoline stain. The flames changed to yellow and orange, and the air started sucking in through the hole where the entrance had been. Within a minute, the whole place was burning. I smiled and took off up the county road. I used headlights for most of the 14 miles, drove fast, took maybe 12 minutes, doused the lights and pulled up a quarter mile short of the target. Turned around in the road and backed up a little way, left the car facing south, down toward town. Doors unlocked, keys in. Hubble carried the big bolt cutter. Finley checked the revolver he'd taken from the office. I reached under the seat and pulled out the plastic bottle we'd filled with gas, slipped it into my pocket with the blackjack. It was heavy. Pulled my jacket down on the right and brought the Desert Eagle up high on my chest. Finley gave me the matches. I put them in the other pocket. We stood together in the dark, in the dirt, on the side of the road, exchanged tight nods, struck out over the field to the blasted tree. It was silhouetted against the moon. Took us a couple of minutes to get there. We slogged over the soft earth, paused against the distorted tree trunk. I took the bolt cutter from Hubble, and we nodded again and headed for the fence where it ran close to the back of the warehouse. It was 10 to 4 in the morning. Nobody had spoken since leaving the burning police building. It was 75 yards from the tree to the fence. Took us a minute. We kept on going until we were opposite the bottom of the fire escape, right where it was bolted down to the concrete path which ran around the whole building. Finley and Hubble grabbed the chain link to put some tension on it, and I bit through each strand in turn with the bolt cutter. Went through it like it was licorice. I cut a big piece out, 7 feet high, right up to where the razor wire started, maybe 8 feet wide. We stepped through the gap, walked over to the bottom of the stairs, waited. I could hear sounds inside, movement and scraping, muffled to a dull boom by the huge space. I took a deep breath, motioned the others to flatten themselves against the metal siding. I still wasn't sure about exterior guards. My gut said there wouldn't be any reinforcements, but Finley was worried about it, and I'd learned a long time ago to take account of what people like Finley worried about. So I motioned the others to stay put, and I crept around to the corner of the massive building, crouched down and dropped the bolt cutter onto the concrete path from a height of about a foot. It made just about the right amount of noise. It sounded like somebody trying to break into the compound. I flattened myself against the wall and waited with the blackjack in my right hand.